This is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. You've made the commitment.
You caught the vision.
You want your family to serve God.
But sometimes it's hard to put feet on that vision. Hey, Hal, do visions have feet?
Shh. How do you get from principle to practice?
What do you need to know about the issues affecting your family?
How do you apply God's Word in the 21st century?
Let's talk about it.
This is Making Biblical Family Life Practical with Hal and Melanie Young. Well, hello, everybody. This is Hal.
And this is Melanie.
And we are talking about making biblical family life practical. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is raising boys. Because after all, we've got six of them.
And, you know, one of the questions we get the most is, what do I do about my child? I think he's hyperactive. And I always ask, well, why do you think that? And say, well, he can't sit still. You know, we sit down and we do school for 2 hours and he's just so active and he wants to get up. And I tell him, we've just got 3 more subjects to do before lunch. Let's press through.
How's that working for you?
It never is. The mom's heart face always falls at that point. She says, it's not. You know, guys are active. God made them active.
Right.
You know, because one day they're going to have to work all day long for a living and come home and still have something to give their family and their church and their community.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a problem. I mean, it is really a problem when you've got things to do, you've got schoolwork to do, whether you're teaching them at home or whether they're in a traditional classroom somewhere, you know, boys are just, they just seem so distracted.
Oh, we've had them too. We've had children that would interrupt themselves.
How does that work?
Well, you know, he's sitting there and he says, Mom, okay, how do I divide 4,248 by 72 first? Okay, and I want to divide and multiply. What is that bird doing out there?
Bird, we were talking about math.
But yeah, I mean, we've had kids that would interrupt themselves.
Wow.
Well, today we're going to talk to Carol Barnier, author of How Do I Get My Kid Off the Refrigerator and Onto Learning, who has a whole community of folks that deal with, what do you do about these highly distractible, very busy kids? Welcome, Carol.
Thanks again for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, Carol, it's always a pleasure. You have a highly descriptive word that you use to describe these young, distractible minds. What is it?
Oh, are you talking about sizzlers?
Yes, that's it exactly.
Yeah.
Just like a pan.
Sizzlers. We call them that because of my son. He did this funny thing when he was a kid. And he was bona fide, you know, diagnosed ADHD along with my husband. And it turns out two more of us qualify. But when he was really young, at one point, he came running into me to tell me something really horrible had happened. And it involved broken light bulbs and smoke. And so, long story short, I find this, you know, broken light bulb. And I noticed that there were these dried drops of liquid on this broken piece of bulb, and I'm like, Glenn, what happened here? And finally, you know, I started realizing that this child had perhaps been spitting on this light bulb. And I said, what were you thinking? Why were you spitting on the light bulb? And he just kind of collapsed and said, because I liked the sizzle. So that sort of became this qualifying statement of these kids. They like to hear the sizzle, see the sizzle, be the sizzle. It just really defined him.
Yeah.
And so we created a community for parents, originally for parents who homeschool, but parents who have a highly distractible child. We call these kids sizzlers, and we call the community sizzle bop, because the bop is sort of, I don't know, the dance of life that goes on around a sizzler and their very unique way of going through the world.
And, you know, it's a lot of fun being in a family like that. We've got a family full of them. I've got a 5-year-old now that I had to beg her. The current challenge is she hums all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's just one note. That's the thing. It's not tunes. Tunes can drive around the bend, but this is like a dial tone.
Yes.
And she's just thinking.
Well, not only the stuff that comes out of our children is funny, the stuff that comes out of our own mouth is kind of funny. We say things to these kids that I'm just convinced parents of normal, calm, compliant children never, ever, ever, ever have to say. And I remember, I kept thinking, you know, maybe it's just our house that has these crazy kind of phrases in it, but I was at church one Sunday, and I listened to this mom saying to her son, Maxie, no, we do not sniff the baptismal font. And I thought, okay, it's not just us.
Oh.
And so we actually had a contest. This is such a hoot. We had a contest called I Can't Believe I Said That. And people, I mean, the entries came pouring in. Things like, no, we don't lick the car. Or, you know, mommy doesn't want to smell your earwax. Or here was one of my favorite ones. How can you not know what you ran into? The bruise is between your eyes. I mean, we got like 100 of these things. And I thought, man, that, you know, hysterical ones. The one that should have won. Now, this is my favorite one. It did not win. We actually took a vote and gave an award out. But the one that should have won for me was this mom who said, spit your brother's tooth back out and give it to him right now. Now, come on. That's funny.
My word.
I just think that's hysterical.
Yeah, we've said a lot of those things. Like, you know, you do not sled down the stairs head first.
Yes.
You know, and you just think, I can't believe that even came out of my mouth. But, you know, I have people come up to me at conferences and they say, one of my children is so strong-willed and so hyperactive. And I say, they say, what do I do? And I say, get down on your knees and thank God it's only one.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what I usually say to those people, too, is while I know that there are challenges with that child, what you need to understand is, you have an Apostle Peter when all the rest of the world has Paul.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's so true, because Paul, here he is, he's studious, he's thoughtful, he's hardworking. And there is Peter. He is mouthing all the time. He is talking before he thinks. He talk about impulse control. He's leaping out of a perfectly seaworthy boat. I mean, this boy had issues.
Yeah.
And so, but at the same time, while I'm convinced Peter is the very first poster child for ADHD, nonetheless, he was one of Jesus' close ones. He was part of the inner circle.
And you know what?
He was one of the ones that Jesus was depending on for the beginnings of his church. So we need to rejoice when we have those strong-willed Peters, because God's got a plan for them too, and it's a good
one. That is so real, Carol. You know, we talk about you know, raising sons and the challenge. And one of the things, I remember one time we were talking about how the things that God puts in our sons that make them so difficult to manage are the things we really want to see in full fruit when they're grown up. And I remember one time, we were standing on stage one time, and Melanie said, do you think Winston Churchill was an easy boy to raise? Never give in, never give in, never, never, never. And I just turned and my jaw dropped. I said, my word, you're absolutely right. That those people who have so much energy, so much drive, so much curiosity that make them absolutely the most destructive force in town are the ones who are going to change the world.
They're the ones that change the world. It's not the compliant, easy-to-raise kids that change the world. And you know what? Yeah, Peter jumped out of the boat, but Peter got to walk on water.
Yeah.
You know, he got to do amazing things. And, you know, I just really want to encourage moms that it's those kids. One of our sons was so strong-willed. You know, at 7, we're thinking law school. At 11, we're thinking reform school. You know? He was just so active and so curious and so passionate and so busy. And I couldn't understand why God made him so hard to raise. And then I saw him as a college student going to an elite college that was very post-Christian and standing firm for Christ in a really, really difficult environment. And I realized that God made him strong because he was going to have to be strong.
Yeah, right. And every bit of that stubbornness and tenacity and persistence that made him a challenge to parent made him an absolute, you know, lion for Christ. You know, and so, you know, we do look at that. But, you know, at the same time, we want to offer hope. But at the same time, we got to live through these years. I mean, we got to make sure that me and this child don't kill each other.
And that we don't have too many holes in the wallboard.
Yeah.
Well, you know, whatever child you have, you know, the hand is not the foot is not the eye. I mean, every child, God has a purpose in mind for the particular gifts and temperament of that child. So if you have one of those rambunctious, stubborn kids, God's got a plan for that. If you have one of those calm and compliant kids, God's got a plan for that. If you've got the kid who's a real encourager, like a Barnabas, God's got a plan for that. But if you've got one who likes to shout from the rooftops and, you know, get into trouble, there's John the Baptist. God has a plan for that. I think we get into trouble when we just pick one model.
Yes.
And we say, my kids, all of my kids, are going to be like that model.
Yeah.
And that's where we get into trouble, because God designed each of them to do something different.
And that's one of the things I think we really get in trouble with boys, because we have this idea that good students sit quietly and they color within the lines and they draw understandable pictures and they are happy to do school and they want the next worksheet. And
some kids do.
Some kids do.
You know, I'm not going to negate this. Some kids do, but those who don't are not bad kids or bad students.
Right.
I mean, there were times, and you know, I've often said Jesus homeschooled. I think people get this, but he did not take his kids in a classroom, you know, his disciples in a classroom. He walked in the fields. He was fishing with them. They're out along the shore. He was walking and talking much of the time with these people. So he understood that very often learning happens while you're in motion. And yet we get here, particularly in the 19th and 20th and the 21st century, and we somehow believe that learning only occurs when you're sitting perfectly still and your feet are flat on the floor and your hands are quiet and you're looking the professor directly in the eyes. For an awful lot of learners, and particularly a lot of boys, that kind of learning just doesn't work.
Yeah, I struggle with
certainly
it myself.
Not.
You know, people ask me, you know, if I've heard this speaker or that speaker, and I seldom have, because unless I can pace in the back of the room, I can't sit still and listen for an hour.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though I stand up on I stand up on stage and teach for an hour lots of times. But
yeah, because you get to move.
Yeah, because I get to move around.
That's what saved us. I think about 6 months into homeschooling, when I first started, I was trying to replicate the traditional school experience in our home. And it's, you know, it's what most homeschoolers do. We kind of, like a cow going to the barn, we just do what's familiar. And when it took me 6 months to finally realize that it wasn't working, and I kind of threw out the system and I began to experiment, the first thing that changed our world for the better was when I realized my son can't learn unless he's moving.
Yes.
So I began to choose the motion, because if I leave it up to him, he's going to move anyway, but it's going to be really annoying. So I said, I'm going to start choosing the motion. So I would come up with, you know, kind of mindless and repetitive things for him to do with his hands while I taught, or while we discussed history, or while we, you know, I read him a story or whatever. And it was one of the biggest changes for us. So an awful lot of what we discuss on Sizzlebop, an awful lot, is how to put motion into the lesson.
Yes.
Because there's a million ways to do it.
That's good, because our most hyperactive, hyperkinetic son, a lot of times wasn't even aware that he was doing things. You know, we'd sit and talk, and he would reach his foot out, and he'd find a pencil that had fallen on the floor. And the whole time he's doing his math, he's rolling that pencil back and forth under his foot. You know, rattle, 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 rattle. And, you know, one of my catchphrases is, son, you are responsible for what every part of your body is doing. You need to be aware of them.
Oh, we have definitely.
And they truly often are not aware. I mean, I think you said that well. But that knowledge is making its way even into the public schools, where they are doing a number of things. I mean, the first thing that came onto the scene was they started getting those great big exercise balls.
Yes.
So instead of sitting on a chair, a kid was sitting on one of those round balls, and they could kind of constantly be in motion. Now the thing I'm seeing a lot is they're getting like bungee cords or some kind of stretchy kind of rubbery material, and they're wrapping it around the legs of the chair.
Yes.
So that they can rest their feet on it and wiggle those around. I mean, there's all kinds of those things so that the kid can constantly be in motion, but it's not noisy or annoying.
Oh, Carol, I saw those bungee cord things. I wanted one for myself.
Yeah, me too.
Well, you know, it reminds...
Now, my new thing is I play with putty a lot. I mean, that's personally my own thing. I constantly have putty in my hand, and I'm constantly, you know, folding it over and folding it over.
Mm.
Everybody's got something.
Well, you know, it reminds me when I was younger, I had a cat, and you know, cats are never quite still. There's always something moving. I remember watching him one day. He was lying on his side asleep somewhere, and the tip of his tail is twitching. You know, he's completely asleep and his tail's twitching. And I just gently put my hand on his tail, and he stopped breathing.
Oh my God.
And I think, okay. I said, ooh, okay. And, you know,
wow.
And I think our kids are that way. I think that they're just, they can't help it. And maybe they don't need to help it. Maybe we need to figure out how to get along with it. It's not always easy having sons. Teenage boys put away a startling amount of groceries. Younger boys can be downright destructive. They're noisy, unconcerned with hygiene, and the dog has a longer attention span, or so it seems some days. If these are God's chosen gifts to us, and we believe that they are, then why does it seem so hard? How can we prepare these boys to serve God when we can barely make it through the day? Isn't there a better way? The answer is yes. Raising Real Men, Surviving, Teaching, and Appreciating Boys by Hal and Melanie Young is a practical, award-winning guide to equipping the hearts and minds of boys without breaking or losing your own. John Rosemond says, "This is just what the doctor ordered for parents who want to raise capable Christian men of character." Raising Real Men by Hal and Melanie Young. Visit it on the web at raisingrealmen.com. Brought to you by Great Waters Press. Well, we want to welcome everybody back to Making Biblical Family Life Practical. I'm Hal.
I'm Melanie, and we're talking today with Carol Barnier, and we're talking about those kids that are just sizzlers, that are full of curiosity and energy and movement, and they can't stop moving, and it's challenging homeschooling those kids. I know we have eight of them. It is really hard to get everybody to sit still, to get everybody to be quiet enough to listen, to do what you need to do. So let's talk about some coping strategies. Carol, what do you do? How do you teach these kids?
Well, once you accept that they need to be moving in order to learn, the world just opens up to you. So it can be as simple a thing as taking their math, textbook away from them. And then you write out the answers and throw the answers on 3x5 cards and throw them out on the floor. So now instead of sitting down and writing out their times tables, I might call out 15, and they have to run over and grab two numbers that multiplied together equal 15. So I've got them up, I've got them moving, but the motions that they're doing are all tied to the lesson. It's not like they're, choosing to do something totally unrelated. So I was always doing things like that. I might take my kids to the park and have them go to the top of the slide, and then we would go through maybe five math facts or, spelling words, and when they get five of them right, they get to go down the slide, back up on the top and wait for the next five. Such a simple thing, and yet if I sat them at home in front of a workbook with a pencil in their hand, that same activity could take hours sometimes, and we can rip through it in, 15 minutes if there's some kind of motion involved in it. So it's that kind of stuff that can change things for you.
Something that's very important to recognize, too, is that boys tend to come into their own academically in high school. Unfortunately, most boys have figured out wrongly that school is not for them by that point. Mm-hmm. And, one thing I really want to encourage parents is your job in those first kindergarten, those first 8 years of school, is to keep your son loving learning. Mm-hmm. And that means, get out and go to the park, get him up and moving, do what it takes that learning doesn't become a drudgery where it takes all his energy just to sit still.
Yeah, and you made a really good point that if they come into their own in college, and yet we've been sold this bill of goods that says they all have to be progressing at exactly the same rate. I think the one that I find most frightening is we've all been sold this bill of goods that they have to learn to read before they leave kindergarten.
Oh.
So we have all of these kids who are just learning to read on a different time frame. They're not late. They're just not going to be reading in kindergarten. And we track them as being, learning disabled, and they've got all of these struggles. And the truth is, they're just not hardwired to learn to read yet in kindergarten.
Yeah.
So I worry that they're not having enough fun and moving around and doing science experiments and making oohs and goos. And, that's the kind of stuff that I think their childhood should be filled with.
Yes.
And science is really an interesting one. I probably get into trouble saying this, but we love science in our house. I mean, you need to know that. Science is just something we have always loved. I have a daughter who's about to graduate with a college degree in chemistry. I mean, we love science. But we did not buy a science textbook until high school. Now, we did science every year. But the thing is, here's what I tell people. Don't read about science. Do science.
Yeah, that's...
Raise worms.
We know. My degree's in biology and chemistry. And I don't think you need a science textbook till high school either.
Because in fact, if you look at the Apologia series that Jay Weil authored, same kind of thing.
Yeah, and the high school stuff, by the time they get to that point, their brains have turned on, they're ready to grasp the theory, to make the connections. We have a son who didn't read till he was 11. But we did lots of learning in those years.
Yeah.
And now he's in high school and he's doing great. He reads ancient philosophers for fun.
Right.
And, you know, I worry that if we're not careful, though, that we'll lose those kids because they'll say, I'm just not academic. I can't do it. When they're academic, when their academic stride hasn't even gotten there yet. And so, yeah, we need to get them up and moving. One thing you mentioned about getting them up and moving is that we've used is whiteboards. Because writing things big has been a help from our little kids to our older kids. Like our guys in college have gotten whiteboards and put them around their dorm room to do calculus equations or to do Chinese character writing on. Because somehow doing it big, the research shows that doing it big is turns on a boy's brain.
Yeah, not only are you, you know, using more gross muscles rather than fine motor skills of like writing with a pencil, but just being up on your feet.
Yes.
And shifting back and forth from one foot to the other. I mean, that little bit of difference of getting away from kneeling over a piece of paper seems to make all the difference in the world.
That's funny. I was reading a while back of a boys' school. I forget. It was somewhere overseas. They were experimenting with standing desks. They were taking all the chairs out. Mm-hmm. And just have all the boys standing up at taller desks than your normal height. And
well, until 100 years ago, boys' schools in England didn't have chairs or stools. They stood. Hmm.
I read that about Donald Rumsfeld, too, that he was someone who, you know, had a desk that was built up several inches. And I got rid of my own chair probably 2 years ago. I haven't sat at a desk in 2 years. And I am so much happier. I have no idea why I didn't do that sooner. But, yeah, I don't use a desk chair either.
And so school doesn't have to look like we picture, with the child in a desk, the light coming over their left shoulder. A boy or a girl could be doing math standing up at the kitchen counter or on a big whiteboard, like Hal's always fond of telling us. Tell them about how to get a cheap whiteboard, Hal.
Yeah, I was over at one of our friends from church. I was over at their family's, at their house, and I was admiring this giant whiteboard they had in the kitchen. And he said, let me tell you about that. He said, that is a sheet of melamine. It's just a paneling material that he bought at Home Depot or one of the homeowner stores like that. And said, I paid $25 for it. It's 4 by 8 feet. And he just put a couple of pieces of molding up on the wall, kind of like rails, and just slipped that big sheet of stuff in there. And it was a perfect whiteboard. And he said, when the surface finally gets worn out and won't erase properly, I just pull it out and go buy another one.
So $25, giant whiteboard. Well, what are some other things?
Yeah, I've heard
What are some other things that parents can do to cope with this whole idea of I've got a kid who is just doesn't seem to have an off button?
Well, I think part of it is you have to go with the fact that they don't have an off button. So give them lots of on things to do, but that are school related things. And as long as you are trying to make school look like a little rows of desks in Laura Ingalls Wilder stories, then you know they're going to absolutely implode. I think there's just so much fun to be had, particularly in science and history, where you are, instead of reading about history, you are acting it out. You are cooking the food from the time period. You are debating, you know, two great orators from that time period. You're having them role play one of them. There's just so many things that you can be doing to learn the lesson that do not involve pouring their heads over a piece of paper and writing. In fact, writing may be a real common thread for a lot of these kids, a struggle for an awful lot of these kids. So there are a couple of things you can do there is we have a rule in our house. We only do writing in writing class.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And if at all possible, we take the pencil out of their hand for almost every other subject. So that means I had to be creative about ways of learning things and going through the process. But one of the first things you can do is to have them learn to type.
Yes.
And we start working on typing as early as kindergarten. And I'm not saying they have to know how to type in kindergarten, but we get some computer games that start teaching the process and familiarizing them with the home keys and playing games and so on. And my kids know you are going to take typing every year until you hit 60 words a minute, and then you can quit. And if you do that in third grade, good, you're done. If it takes you till 12th grade, that's what we're going to do. But something kind of miraculous happens right around, I don't know, 45, 50 words a minute. Suddenly, this kid can pretty much type about as quickly as he thinks.
Yes.
He can get the words out quickly enough. But and so finally, the process of having the words kind of having to hang in this like holding pattern over his head while he tries to painstakingly write out a single word and remember how it's spelled and grips the pencil too tightly in his hand is tired. All of that is done when he can start typing about 50 words a minute. And it changes his ability to compose and think and edit and rearrange. So that's something I really encourage parents to do. But another thing is, when your kids are too young and they can't type yet, be their hands.
That's sometimes just what I was going to say.
At the keyboard. Just let them dictate it to you and you type it for them. Because they're still doing the creative process. They're still creating the words. I would even say, even if your child doesn't struggle with writing, when you have young children, every now and then, be their hands. Because for them, it's kind of like they're published. I mean, they get to see their words complete and whole on the page for the first and maybe the only time.
It's amazing,
and it's
too.
It's really motivating.
It's amazing to see what they can create when they're released from that constraint of writing it. Because,
I agree.
And I learned this the hard way with our son who learned to read late. He was struggling with writing. And he just said wistfully, he said, I really wish I could participate in those essay contests at the Museum of History like my brothers did. But I just can't write like that. And I thought, I picked up the phone and I called him. And I said, can he dictate this to me? And they said, sure, as long as he does his own research and you type whatever he says.
Yep.
That year he won number one in the state of North Carolina.
Wow. And you know what he needed? To know that he was good at that.
Badly.
Because here's my thought about writing, is if we force kids to use writing as part of absolutely every single subject, they will proceed in absolutely every single subject at the speed of their weakest skill.
Yes.
So they come to believe they're lousy at math, when the truth is they're lousy at writing.
Yes.
And they think they're lousy at science, when the truth is they're lousy at writing.
Yeah.
So if we free them from that, suddenly all of their strengths just explode and emerge.
Yeah, you made an important point back there. There's a difference between writing and the idea of composing thoughts into words versus pushing a pen across a piece of paper.
Handwriting
is different than the creative, penmanship is different than the creative process of verbal communication. And we found this with one of our older sons. He was not dyslexic. Everybody knows about dyslexia. And he reads faster than anybody in the family, but he was severely dysgraphic. Handwriting was almost painful for him. And when an uncle gave him a secondhand laptop, suddenly the world opened up and he could communicate in ways he never had before. I mean, he went from, I can't stand to write a paragraph, to writing 15,000 words in a short story contest he was working on.
Yeah.
And, a lot of parents worry that if they don't push handwriting from the time they're little, their kids will have awful handwriting when they're adults. And I've just found that's not true. Some of my kids that I let them use dictation forever. They use typewriters. But, when they got old enough that their minds could do that, that their small motor skills came into play, they have gorgeous handwriting now. But it's just they weren't able to do it then. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, in fact, in this day and age, I'm more horrified by teachers who push handwriting and don't have their kids learn to type. I'm thinking, everybody needs those computer skills now. And I don't know. And, I look at my husband, love him dearly, very well educated, and did the traditional school model of learning handwriting. And to this day, he has horrible handwriting. And so the reverse can also be true, where, I have never yet met a doctor with great handwriting, nor an accountant or engineer. And so I think there's this kind of brilliance that will almost invariably lead to horrible handwriting. And I don't think it's necessarily something that if they had just gotten more handwriting practice in school, they would have done better. I don't think that's the issue. I think there are intelligences at work here, too.
Well, that is so true. And I'm convinced that's true about spelling, too. We know people who have never misspelled a word ever and never took spelling. Mm-hmm. And others that have had spelling year after year after year and still can't spell anything. I think some people can spell and some people can't.
Yeah, and it's not an IQ issue as in, people who aren't bright can't spell. I almost think the reverse is true. An awful lot of really brilliant people can't spell.
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's a type of intelligence here that is such a certain part of the brain that is so powerfully equipped, and somehow spelling gets lost in it.
Well, they said Agatha Christie's handwriting and spelling was so horrible that they had to assign a particular editor to her, because only one editor could understand what she wrote, and they had to constantly call her and contact her to get her to explain sentences to her, to them.
Oh, I love that story.
Oh, you know,
that's great.
You know, I was reading a book by Richard Brookhiser, who worked with worked very closely with William F. Buckley for many years, and he said he said Buckley had atrocious handwriting. And so everybody rejoiced when he got his first computer because they thought, finally. They said, if you can believe it, he had bad handwriting on the computer. His email was unreadable. They said he had to have, you know, it was remarkable. And, you know, Buckley is one of the most eloquent, erudite individuals in the English language. And they said, man, you know, it wasn't a lack of intelligence at all.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that homeschoolers in particular worry so much that we're not going to do right by our children, that sometimes we don't do right by our children because we expect things of them that are unnecessary or that they're not ready to do. They're not developmentally ready.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, you go to every support group meeting you go to, there's always someone who's doing what I call that gee whiz factor.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
They're doing something that's so impressive. And so we keep adding to our list. We start out the school year with a reasonable list, but then we keep adding to it to the point that it's crazy. So we need to take a breath and come up with our objectives at the beginning of the year and stick to our guns.
Yeah. Well, Carol, I mean, this is so refreshing, and you keyed into this early on. We get in these communities of people who have highly distractible, sizzling kids, particularly boys, and when you hear other people's stories, you say, oh, it's not just me. It's not just our house that looks like a den of mongooses. I mean, there's other people like this, and it's such a relief, such an encouragement, and then we get the practical help. And we really appreciate you talking with us and helping us to maybe point people in that direction.
Now, Carol, I want you to tell us about, you have three books that address this in one way or another. I want you to tell us about those three books.
Sure. The first one came about after years of homeschooling, just collecting all of these kind of unusual ways of teaching that worked with this distractible child. So that one's called How to Get Your Child Off the Refrigerator and Onto Learning. And, I mean, parents who get that automatically know what I'm talking about, the kid who truly does climb the walls all the time. And then I used to speak on that topic all over the country, and moms would come up to me and say, well, forget the kid. Where's the book for the distractible mom? And I realized, yeah, we need to address that, too, because that's where I live. So the next book's called If I'm Diapering a Watermelon, Then Where'd I Leave the Baby? And so, I mean, that kind of distractibility, I'm not just, you know, it's not something I researched and I'm telling you about. That's where I live. I really am the Lucy Ricardo of homeschooling.
You know,
so those are from the trenches writing.
I have to laugh, Carol. One of our sessions is called Ballistic Homeschooling. And always.
Yeah, and parents who just have girls don't get it.
They come up and they say, what is this about? What are you talking about? And I say, it's about homeschooling boys. They say, well, why did you call it ballistic? And the mom standing next to her would say, why wouldn't she?
Yeah.
You know, because, yeah, you get it. If you've been there, you get it.
Well, that's why I so love the title of that first book, How to Get Your Child Off the Refrigerator and Onto Learning, because people will come up to my book table and they read that title and they either totally get it or totally don't. And if they don't get it, you know, I know it's not the book for them. We've got nothing to talk about. They might as well move on down and find that book on, you know, how calm, compliant children learn their times tables. I don't know, something else.
Yeah.
But for parents who get it, it's like this giant exhale because they know that there are people who understand and that have been there and that they're not alone.
It's not just us. Now tell me about the third book.
So, the third book, the last one is a little bit broader. It's a learning styles book called The Big What Now Book of Learning Styles. And the reason it's called that is so many of the learning styles books that were out there that I started reading spent, I don't know, like 90% of their pages coming up with just a really good label to call your child. And then they spent the last 10% of the pages telling you how to teach to that label. And I thought, that's really backwards, because the real action happens in the teaching, not in the, what am I going to call them before I start teaching?
Yes.
So I ended up coming up with a book that talks a little bit about the labels and the various learning styles, but it's called The Big What Now Book of Learning Styles, because it's like, well, okay, so I know what he is. What now? How do I teach it? And 90% of the book is how do you teach a child who needs to move? How do you teach a child who's primarily visual? How do you teach a child who's very auditory in their learning? And subject by subject, we go through and tell you how to teach each of those subjects to those different learning styles.
Oh, that sounds great. Now tell us, how do we get to the Sizzlebop community?
You know, it's so easy. Sizzlebop.com.
Awesome.
That's where you'll find us. Yeah, and then that, from there, all things branch out from there.
Great. That's great. This has been a blessing, Carol. It's so much fun talking to somebody else who gets it, who understands what it's like to teach a house full of mongoose. Is it mongooses? Mongoose? I don't know. Wild, curious, interesting people.
Yeah.
Well,
who have a great future ahead of them.
That's right.
That's true. There is hope, and Carol Barnion can help you find it. So we do appreciate Carol being here with us, and we appreciate you being here with us too. So until next Monday at 9 o'clock, you can listen to us live, or you can catch us on iTunes as we're taking biblical principles into the 21st century family. I'm Hal.
I'm Melanie.
And we appreciate you being here. Thanks so much, Carol, and thank you to our listeners too.
See you next week, folks. Bye.
You've been listening to Making Biblical Family Life Practical with Hal and Melanie Young. If you found this program interesting, challenging, and encouraging, why not join us on the web at halandmelanie.com. That's HalandMelanie.com. Or follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/HalandMelanie or Facebook.com/RaisingRealMen. This program is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. Join us next week when we'll be back to talk about making biblical family life practical. Until then, thank you and God bless you for listening.